It was September 1966. It was the new television season. Just like any other, and NBC was about to debut their new science fiction show. That in itself wasn't a novel idea. CBS had Lost in Space. ABC had contemporary shows like The Time Tunnel and Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. It was pretty standard that networks had something on the air that fell into the general category of science fiction. And while these shows had their own quaint charms, they lasted a few seasons and mostly drifted off into memory and then later syndication. The other one-hour drama that every network had was a Western. NBC already had a bona fide hit in Bonanza, and CBS with Wild Wild West nearly combined the Western with sci-fi. Well, on the evening of the 8th of September, 1966, following Daniel Boone, this new NBC show premiered with an episode called The Man Trap. The angle of the story was different, to say the least. It was a love story with sort of a sci-fi twist, born of a relationship from the doctor's past, featuring a monster that, in the end, just wanted to live. It was moving, tragic, and anything but cheesy. The viewers, at least the ones who were paying attention, were hooked. The show proved it had something different. It had a unique life that would go on to exist beyond expectation. It stood outside of time as it trapped into universal themes and epic struggles and put the cosmos on notice. Things have changed. Primetime on NBC eventually proved that this was no place for something so big, so broad in scope. This three-season show, after all, would go on to spawn four live-action spin-offs, an animated series, 10 movies and counting, plus a licensing empire that to this day embraces books, videos, exhibits, and assorted merchandise. Like other cultural, artistic, or philosophical phenomena, this new show was largely unappreciated in its own time and only later would be seen as it is today, a worldwide cultural juggernaut. Thanks to a form of television recycling called syndication, the show became a hit to generations of young, impressionable kids, including many future scientists, astronauts, actors. What's ironic is that by today's rating standards, it would have been a hit in its own original run, but back then, the only three major networks, it didn't quite pull its weight. It was only with the need to syndicate TV programs to get more than one bite out of the entertainment cherry did the show become what it was all along. It just needed a form of resurrection. The people who had heard of it from their parents, teachers, friends, or older siblings turned in to their school prior to the dinner hour. It turned out to be the perfect time to hit this new, fresh audience, and the show became lodged in the collective minds of a nation. But why? There may have been many soundbites trying to explain its success, the visions of the future. Newspaper and magazine column inches, books on how the philosophy of this show has influenced people from politicians to scientists to philosophers to talk show hosts, and now websites and blogs have all been devoted to explaining its personal and mass appeal. Everyone, it seems, has their take on why one little show has lasted throughout the ages. And the beauty of it is that everyone is right. It's the infinite diversity of opinion from an infinite combination of people that has helped lend the show to its uniqueness. Yes, it had a crew that said discrimination was a thing of the past. It had a future that said we were not all annihilated by nuclear holocaust. It had an economy that was driven by progress and achievement, not simple wealth accumulation. It had means to explore, not just make life easier. Not mysticism or superstition. And perhaps more importantly, it had a peaceful mission at its core, not one of conquest. The show screamed peace in a time of war. All of these reasons helped contribute to the show's success. But so did the iconic characters, the top-notch writing, the new technology, and the great, for then, special effects. The show that aired that night was called Star Trek. And today it's birthday, 40 years. We'd like to wish a very happy birthday to Star Trek and a big thank you to Gene Roddenberry for having the intelligence, the foresight to see into the future, a future at last. And dream the impossible dream. Some time ago, I had a great opportunity to talk with Walter Koenig, Chekhov, about Star Trek. You know, Walter, beyond the acting in Star Trek and Babylon 5, which we'll talk about, you are a pretty accomplished writer. You're doing films. You've done films. You're doing some internet work as well. You keep on top of technology. Of everything you've done in your career, is there one facet that you have enjoyed more than the other?
Well, you know, it's pretty much apples and oranges, I think. You know, there's some avenues that, you know, appeal to the visceral part of me, and others, if I may so boldly use the word, intellectual properties.
Sure.
That I have. So at different times I am, you know, enamored of different art forms. When I write well, I think that's the most satisfying thing. I haven't always written well. I've written some screenplays and other things that were left wanting, but I've also done some stuff that I was quite proud of. And so I get a measure of accomplishment from writing that perhaps I don't get from anything else to that level of gratification.
Your career that had you rolling through Chicago and New York, how did you end up in Los Angeles? How did that occur for you?
Well, actually, I finished school at UCLA, and I graduated with a degree in psychology. But I had I took one acting class, and I had a teacher who became a mentor to me, and his name was Arthur Friedman, and he represented the West Coast branch of the Neighborhood Playhouse, and on his recommendation, I went back to study acting professionally.
Mm-hmm.
I really was at a loss as to what else I was going to do in my life. I graduated with a degree in psychology, as I said, but I really didn't feel that that was where my destiny lie. So I went back, and I had two really terrific years, and Sidney Pollack was one of my teachers, and Sidney was assisting John Frankenheimer cast the film that was going to be shot initially in New York called Young Savages with Burt Lancaster and Shelley Winters. They changed the venue, and they decided to bring it out here, and Sid said to me that should I find a way to get out to Los Angeles on my own, he would make sure that I would be in the film. So I did. I came out here. It didn't turn out that way. I mean, it's sort of a baptism of fire because I learned that through events that nobody's necessarily responsible for, things change and it doesn't work out the way you want it to.
How did the Star Trek position of Pavel Chekhov come to be?
Well, gee, I haven't been asked that question before.
No, never comes up. That's it.
I had done, I think it was 63, I had done an episode of a series called Mr. Novak, and I played the part of a defecting Russian student who came to the United States. And it was a guest-starring role, and it went well. And the casting director on that show was also the casting director, you know, 4 years later on Star Trek. His name was Jody Augusta. And also, I worked in an episode of The Lieutenant, which was another series created by Gene Roddenberry, and I had done a guest starring role on that. And finally, I had done a very prominent role on an episode of the Alfred Hitchcock Presents, and the director of that show was one of the two alternating directors on Star Trek in the second season when I came aboard. So when my name came up, it was almost a fait accompli that I would. There was only one other actor being considered, so I got the part almost by default.
Now, in terms of notoriety, when you are walking around the streets of Los Angeles, is that the part that people remember you the most for?
Oh yeah, for Chekhov. There's no question. If they indeed remember me at all at this point.
Oh, they do. You'll find out when we open up the phone lines. The part of what was it like working with Bill Shatner?
Oh, don't ask that.
Come on, and Leonard Nimoy, and because everybody loves Star Trek, and they want to know what goes on behind the scenes.
Oh, okay. Read between the lines. I thought Leonard was a very talented actor. He was absolutely perfect for the role of Spock. I don't think another actor could have played it so effectively. He was a very much a student of acting and very conscientious about being in character. So we saw him in character most of the time, even when we weren't in front of the camera. George Takei is a delightful man, a very well-rounded person with great cultural interests. He's done so many good things for the Japanese American community as well as for the country in general. Sure. I think Nichelle is absolutely charming, a wonderful singer. I've been delighted to be to be associated with her. DeForest was a true Southern gentleman, a man of compassion and a great pal, and Jimmy was as well. Jimmy was a neat guy, somebody that was mercurial, emotionally was mercurial. You had to be careful on occasion when his temper flared, but he was a delightful guy, and again, it's very sad that we have lost him.
And Shatner?
No, I just said read between the lines. Uh-huh. Those are the people that I will discuss.
Talk about.
Yeah.
Okay. The episodes of Star Trek, as you look at what's happening now worldwide, isn't it amazing of some of the things Roddenberry was thinking of? The one world, the coalition, the federation. Seems like we're kind of getting that way now.
Well, are we? Jeez, I don't know. It seems like we're in a more... the way the world is now is we're more fractured and disparate. And less in unity than we have been, for a long time. So I don't think we are achieving the ideals that he wrote about. I wish we were. I think perhaps that's one of the attractions of Star Trek, is that it did map out a future in which people really did get along, where everybody really respected and cared for each other. And our differences, we were a cast, we were a crew of different racial, ethnic, national origins, and we learned to, which I think was the operative term here, is we learned to maintain our cultural individuality and our cultural identity. We didn't have to sacrifice that in order to come together, and I think as a cohesive unit, that's what's missing in this world. I think that we can't seem to respect each other's beliefs, religious, whatever our ideologies are, and still find some sense of unity. So I think we're a long way from Gene Roddenberry's dream.
Did you have fun as the psychop, Alfred Bester?
I loved being Alfred Bester. That was the greatest fun I've had in television, to play that role. It was a dimensional role. I got to explore different facets of character. It was always an adventure because J. Michael Straczynski kept writing things that... things for the character that were not self-evident, and then I had to somehow make them a part of the overall personality of Bester. So it was a challenge, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I could have, that's a role that I would have been happy to play for another 3 or 4 years had it eventuated that way.
Yeah. Walter, what new projects are you working on now?
Well, I've got a couple. One isn't really new. We've been trying to get a feature film made called Illegal Alien for some time now. We've come very close on a couple of occasions to raising the financing. It's a project that's very dear to my heart that I wrote and that I won't be doing. I won't be doing the most prominent role in it, but I do have a character role in it that I'll be doing. And I'm very excited about that. We've been meeting with folks, my partner and I. And hopefully that will come to pass, maybe, very soon. I certainly hope so.
So that's Walter Koenig, Chekhov. And in a moment, get ready to pop the champagne. I'll be back with you along with our
Master of Ceremonies for this 40th anniversary party of Star Trek, Richard C. Hoagland. We're next with your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Well, you all know Richard C. Hoagland, head of the EnterpriseMission.com. He is with us on this 40th anniversary of Star Trek for the rest of this hour. Richard, the EnterpriseMission.com website, the name, one can guess you got it from Star Trek?
I got it from Gene directly. Gene and I mean, I was one of the luckiest guys at 20 on the planet. I got to meet and work with and become a friend and colleague to one of my heroes, Gene Roddenberry. And it started in this date, literally 40 years ago tonight. My family was very busy. You know, my dad and my mom worked, and I had, you know, three brothers and sisters, and we actually, you know, did some singing on the side in addition to being in school. And then everybody decided at some point that summer that we were going to get a cottage down by the ocean in the eastern part of Massachusetts, mm-hmm. Cape Cod, and all go down and kind of hang out and be like beach bums and, you know, see what Provincetown was like and, you know, basically have a vacation, except me. Because I had noticed on NBC, you know, little black and white broadcast TV back then, this promo, this teaser showing this strange-looking vehicle in orbit around a planet. And because of my background in the museum, because I was doing the museum work at the same time, I instantly saw that whoever was behind this show knew something about space. And in graphics, and there were no computer graphics in those days. It was all, you know, handheld animation or hand-drawn animation and models and photography. And I just said, I got to stay home. So the family went off to this first vacation in years and years and years. And there I am in Springfield, Massachusetts, all by myself, watching that night this extraordinary episode of the Man Trap. And I watched, you know, Kirk and Spock interact and the phasers and, you know, the changing creature and, you know, Nurse Chapel introduced. And, I mean, as you said at the top of the show, George, I was hooked. I was so hooked that I at that time, I had a radio show. I had my own radio show. You didn't know that, right?
No, you were just how old were you?
I was 20, 21.
Why? Kid.
Yep. And I actually commuted to three jobs to make ends meet. I was at the museum during the day. Then I had a morning show on a little station called DEW in Westfield, Massachusetts. DEW named after the Dew Line.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I had another one in Manchester, which is a CBS affiliate. Well, that's another story.
And you were going all over the
place. I was going all over. I wasn't sleeping at all. And I was, you know, and what I did was I basically, you know, had this show. And what I would do every week, the morning after, because NBC broadcast Star Trek on Thursday nights, on Friday morning for my show, because, you know, the station manager and the program director, they didn't think that a guy from a museum could do radio. And I saw somebody else doing it. I said, come on, I can do that. Anybody who can talk can do that. So what I did is I introduced Star Trek into talk radio every Friday morning.
That's fantastic.
And we would discuss the episodes and the political and the socio comparisons and what, you know, the writers are trying to do in the way of current lessons. Because remember, this is in the late 60s, 68. There's riots, there's, you know, Chicago, there's, you know, the Chicago 7, there's, you know, Vietnam, there's protests, there's Nixon, there's, I mean, there were all kinds of things that Gene was trying to say obliquely, you know, tell all the truth but tell it slant, as Emily Dickinson used to say.
Sure.
So I had this incredible audience going through Star Trek as metaphor for the times we lived in. And then I went to a science fiction convention up in Amherst, which is where the University of Massachusetts is located, and I met Fred Pohl. And I actually gave Fred, you know, a ride at the airport. He'd broken his arm, and he couldn't drive, and he was sitting there in the car with his big cast, and we're talking on the way to the airport, you know, about stuff, because I was a fan of John Campbell and science fiction and all that, and he was one of the giants even then. And he happened to mention that Star Trek was going off the air. And I almost drove off the road. You know, you almost broke the other arm.
Stay with us, Richard. We're going to be back in a moment. We'll continue talking with Richard about Star Trek, get his take on why 40 years since it was on first, is it just as popular as ever? And we'll open up the phone lines, too, if you want to chat with Richard about Star Trek. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Well, we're going to still talk with Richard C. Hoagland about Star Trek. We're going to take your phone calls this hour. This, of course, being the 40th anniversary of Star Trek, our master of ceremonies, Richard C. Hoagland this hour. Richard, all dressed up in a tuxedo, not a black tie, though. He still wears that bow line. Just can't get rid of that thing around his neck. Back in a moment. Digicam will go up later on tonight. You'll see Richard C. Hoagland in his bola. Richard, did you notice in that Walter Koenig interview that I did, the friction that appeared between, I guess, Shatner and some of the crew? Did you sense that?
That's been part of fandom for years and years. Let me quickly end the other story and then get on to a Bill Shatner story.
Yeah.
So knowing that Star Trek was going off, I turned to a friend of mine who I'd met, because I reached out and used the telephone and called anybody in the country having a museum behind me. And I called Isaac Asimov and I said, what the hell is going on? Are they taking this off? And it just got on and it's so incredible. And he says, yes. And he says, Gene Roddenberry's asked me to be on a committee. And he says, maybe you ought to try to do something. So I pick up the phone and I called Gene Roddenberry in Hollywood.
And you got to him?
He was listed.
I love
and he
it.
Picked up the phone and he said, I'm in my basement, sitting on the basement floor. I'm working on he did lapidary, George. He was a very accomplished jeweler.
Okay.
In fact, he designed the original itik. Remember the itik that Spock wore around his chest with the symbol, the Star Trek symbol, called Infinite Diversity, Infinite Combination?
Boy, you know it better than I do.
Oh, I lived it. Come on.
All right.
Anyway, so I got Gene on the phone. And I said, I've got this little radio station. I'm a museum curator. What can I do to help? And that was the beginning, as Humphrey Bogart used to say, of a beautiful friendship.
I love it.
And it, from then on, I submitted ideas for the show. I did technical consulting. He had Alexander Courage send me reel-to-reel tapes of the Star Trek themes for use in the planetarium. I was the first planetarium in the world to play Star Trek music behind the serious science stuff we were doing at the Springfield Museum of Science and there in Springfield, Massachusetts.
And now everybody uses it.
Now everybody uses it, you know. So, I mean, it was, to me, Star Trek was not just a television show. Its longevity obviously attests that it struck some archetypal chord in every generation who has come to it. And when I went to consult, you know, for CBS, it was the last season, and I was sitting in the control room watching on one screen the preparations for Apollo 8, and I'm watching on another screen one of the episodes of the third season of Star Trek when it was just about to die and go off the air. And it was such an interesting contrast because Star Trek captured the imagination. It was to boldly go where no one has gone before, which NASA did in the early years up through Apollo. And then it fell apart, George. It's like the tragedy is, why am I sitting here tonight watching a live TV shot on satellite of the Cape of Atlantis sitting there on the pad, a 30-year-old ancient archaic technology, a museum piece, a classic spacecraft we're trying to launch with baling wire and string and Band-Aids, when we should have warp drive and, you know, artificial gravity and all the things that Star Trek showed us in the latter part of the 20th century?
Shatner.
When I was with NASA, I was part of a project called, I forget what the communication satellite thing was, but I was supposed to do a demonstration of a geosynchronous direct point-to-point satellite communications technology with Fordham University. So I said, oh, I know what I'll do. So I got hold of Shatner, and I said, you know, would you like to participate and demonstrate how we now have the equivalent of the Star Trek communicator? And he said, well, I'm going to be on location shooting a movie. And he named some canyon out here in a place called New Mexico, which, of course, they didn't know about New Mexico then. And lo and behold, we got him the technology. We actually made it work, and I stood on a stage in front of a whole auditorium full of college kids, who are the hardest audience to hold on the planet, as you know.
Oh, sure.
Talking to Captain Kirk over a NASA Star Trek prototype communicator into a canyon somewhere in the wilds of New Mexico where he was shooting a movie about spiders. Remember that movie he did?
Oh,
the Monster Spiders?
Yes.
Yeah, well, and I found Bill a delight to work with because he, I mean, you've noticed that he's been picked to be narrator for a lot of NASA stuff. It's because he really liked the idea of science and technology and going where no one had gone before. But Bill were great.
But he must have been a tough guy to get along with.
Well, any perfectionist. I mean, Bill is an artist. If you go back and look at the original series, you know, people have said snidely, oh, Shatner can't act. I mean, Keith Olbermann the other night was doing kind of an imitation of Shatner.
Yeah.
Shatner is a very good actor. Remember one of our favorite Twilight Zones?
Which one?
The one where he's in the airplane at 30,000 feet.
Yeah.
And sees the monster on the wing.
He sees the gremlin.
I mean, that was my first introduction to Bill. And then, of course, in the series, I thought Bill was perfect as Gene's vision of what a Horatio Hornblower, captain of a starship / warship, would be in the 23rd century.
Kingdom of the Spiders.
Yes, that was the name.
Let's take some calls, Richard.
Sure.
While we celebrate with a little champagne. I know you and Robin are probably doing that now. First time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, welcome.
Hi. This is interesting that I'm calling in on the Star Trek topic of all the calls I should actually get through on.
Well, your luck. Go ahead.
Then you must have a great story.
I was going to ask, with the anniversary of Star Trek, I'd just like to say happy birthday to Star Trek and to Gene Roddenberry, and long live his memory. I was wondering, do you think that the Star Trek will continue? Do you think they'll have more series and more things coming up? Do you think that it will continue and stay just as strong as it has been?
Well, I was sent tonight by way of Robin, one of her friends on a board that she frequents on the Internet, a guy called Storm, sent us a press release from CBS Paramount. Apparently, George, they're planning to bring out the original 79 episodes on redigitized, remastered, and completely redone special effects.
They're going to clean it up with new technology?
They're going to clean it up with new technology. It'll be the original actors, original scenes, original dialogue, original, but new music, new outside effects. They're going to, this will be very interesting to see if this works, because it's like, how do you mess with a classic? But apparently it's going to be run on affiliates, again, in series all over the country. And I know that TV Land is doing a marathon this week because of the anniversary tonight, and they announced tonight that they are going to be broadcasting in the next week or two new episodes of the original series, which I guess is part of the CBS Paramount announcement.
What was the secret of Star Trek?
We have all wondered for some. I used to have long arguments with Gene about this because he didn't see himself as a real-world pioneer. He saw himself as a writer first, a producer, a guy who made magic, who tried to say some things in an entertaining form. You know the old, what was it, Barnum, who said, if you have a message, you know, send a telegram?
Yeah.
But Gene created an archetypal image of American society for our time, projected into a limitless environment where we could meet and get to know and live with in peace all kinds of diverse cultures. And I listened carefully to the question you were asking, Walter, as to whether we see that here. And yes, we do. But we don't. It is not amplified by national media. You know, bad news gets headlines. You know, man bites dog is a headline. Dog bites man is normal, so you don't see that as a headline. People getting along is normal.
Yeah.
So we don't see all the incredibly positive things going on where diversity, I mean, we live in so much of a diverse and forgiving, if I can use that term, or admissible culture now, that when Gene tried, and he would tell me these horror stories about how he tried to get, you know, various things on Star Trek on the network, and he had to hide them. For instance, he had the first black woman in commercial broadcast television.
You're right.
Uhura.
You're right.
Nichelle Nichols, who became a very good friend of mine.
She was up there in a prominent position?
Absolutely. Yeah. Then he was able to get the first interracial kiss between Kirk and Nichelle on Star Trek.
I don't remember that.
Oh, yeah. That was a scene where there were these Play Those Children, I think was the episode, where there were these so-called Greek super beings that had magical powers, you know, telekinesis and all that. And they wound up forcing the crew of the Enterprise to go through various parodies until it was discovered by McCoy that it was a plant they were eating. And so he gave them all shots, and they developed equivalent powers. And, you know, they were subjecting a dwarf, a small person in the show to, you know, heinous, you know, indignities and stuff like that. Well, these guys forced Uhura and Kirk to kiss. And at that point, it was basically a look what we can do and what is against mores. It was very clear that Gene had multiple levels of a message in this program. But again, it was a groundbreaking historical breakthrough for television that he was able to get this on the air when it was absolutely not permitted by social mores of the time.
I was more interested at the time in sports, so it went right over my head. Next up, west of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, how you doing, George?
We are well, thanks.
All right. Hey, Richard.
Yes?
I'm a huge Star Trek fanatic, okay? And I read a book some time ago called The Meaning of Star Trek, and it connected Carl Jung's archetypes of the four elements. Have you ever heard anything about that, where Kirk represents the fire signs, Scotty represents the earth signs, Dr. McCoy is the water signs, and Spock is the air signs?
I don't think I've read that particular one, but I know that in the last 40 years there's been, you know, thousands of books written. You know, we used to discuss, long before the Internet, with, you know, fans, the meaning of these characters, why they, you know, struck such a responsive chord. You know, I mean, Gene was a genius in that his casting, George,
was
phenomenal. I mean, can you imagine anybody else but Leonard Nimoy playing Spock?
He took a hands-on approach to every aspect of that program.
Absolutely, and that's why it succeeded, because the you know, he had to be captain, he had to see his vision, and for him to be able to, against the commercial vicissitudes of broadcast television, get something so cutting edge that even now when I watch it, it holds up. It's not lame. It actually is still making statements, and I love the original series. I mean, Next Generation was also phenomenal because Gene did what no one in Hollywood, and even I didn't think he could do, which would be to top himself.
And it went on and on.
And it goes on and on and on, and it's so relevant. I mean, back when Gene had the stroke and was, you know, almost at death's door, is when I started the Enterprise mission as an educational project on Capitol Hill, and I remember asking him if I had permission to do that, and he sent me a very nice note, and he wished me well, and, you know, that was the last time that we ever communicated. And the idea came to me to change, you know, his opening, which was to boldly go, to boldly go where someone has gone before, because the Enterprise mission I'm leading, which is an absolute, you know, archetypal, you know, imprimatur of what Gene's philosophy was, is that the real universe out there, the universe that we're not being allowed to see because of venial people, both in NASA and other places, is the universe that everyone who's a Star Trek fan wants, deserves, can appreciate, has as its heritage, because this is us, guys. This is what we used to do a long, long time ago. And the only thing that I'm really sad about is that Gene and I aren't around to have incredible, wonderful arguments about the meaning of Mars, Cydonia, what's on the moon, and that I can't invite him like I'm inviting you to Joshua Tree in a few weeks.
East of the Rockies, you're up with Richard C. Hoagland. Hi there.
Gentlemen, it's Gary. And first of all, I'd like to take the USS Enterprise and round up 25 million illegal aliens in America. Now, first of all, if you look at Captain Kirk's walkie-talkie, it's identical to today's cell phones. Captain Kirk is also very, very good friends with Greg Brady, the actor, Barry Williams. Also, in the episode, which was one of the great episodes that I loved, it was a future episode where they go into the future with the Enterprise and they come to the USA in the year 2008. And there is Captain Kirk congratulating President-elect Tom Tancredo. Great show.
Unbelievable. I don't remember that one.
I don't either.
But that was one of the great ones. That was a great episode.
I don't remember it.
And, I remember and this the one where he goes back Kratos in time assistant. To a Saturn launch and has to basically change the a missile test, you know, using the Enterprise and using stealth and using, you know, trickery so that we didn't, you know, wind up in World War III. That was one of those wonderful time travel. There were a couple, three time travel episodes. That was one. It starred Robert, oh, what's his name?
Nothing ever shakes you, does it?
No.
Nothing. that guy's thing, you just kept going.
Well, this is a night for celebration. I mean,
that's because you're probably into three bottles of champagne by now. No, I'm kidding. You know that.
I know you're kidding.
Wildcard Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, this is Ben from Appleton.
Yeah, hello, Ben.
Hi, Richard. Hi, George.
Hi.
I just had two quick questions for Richard. First, do you know if there was any Cydonia or Face on Mars references in the original episodes of Star Trek?
That's a good question. Anything like that, Richard?
No,
what was Viking? Viking was what year, first of all?
1976.
Yeah, well, by that time, most of Star Trek, unless he put it in some of the movies.
Well, there are allusions in Next Generation. Remember, the real spaceport is at Mars, where they assemble the ships.
Yes.
But no, I mean, Gene died before we could really get into it. I remember going down one day when I lived in California, spending the entire day with him, taking all the photographs. You know, this is in the early 80s, all the Cydonia work I'd done up to that point, and laid it out on the floor, and, you know, Susan, his assistant, was baffled why we were closeted in his office for hours and hours, and I had all these prints, 11 by 14 prints, 16 by 20 prints, all over his office floor. And at the end, he sat behind his desk, and he steepled his fingers, and he looked at me, and he says, "But, Dick, if this was real, it would be on television." The most important advice that I think he could ever have given me, because I have now worked diligently, as you have, George, to bring what you do to television. And I can tell you that a major network is coming here in the next few days to film us extensively on our work over the last 20 years on Cydonia, Mars, artifacts, that will wind up on major network television next spring.
I heard rumors about that. Richard, we're almost out of time. First of all, thanks for coming to the party here for the 40th anniversary of Star Trek. Very soon, your Joshua Tree conference is about to begin, and in a couple weeks. What's your toll-free number for that? Of course, everybody who has a computer, it's on your website.
Yep, and the toll-free number, which I have here, is 1-800-900-7030. That's 1-800-900-7030. And one of the things we're talking, I mean, we're talking 2012, but George, we're also going to be talking context. What's wrong with NASA? Why are we not getting the information that I'm going to be showing of these stunning artifacts on Mars and the Moon? You know, where did we go wrong? Why is the real universe that Star Trek tried to lay out for us in the way of imagination, why is it top secret? Why is it prohibited? Why is it where we're not supposed to go?
Yeah, it's not like the old NASA.
Not at all. Or like Gene's vision of a program that refuses to die because it's in every one of our hearts.
Go to the Digicam, by the way, and take a look at Richard C. Hoagland with his Bola. Sorry I did this to you, Rich. You have to go up there
and take
a look at it. Okay, have a good weekend, Richard.
You too.
Yeah, let's keep our fingers crossed for the space shuttle, huh?
I'm going to be watching all night. I'll be here. If something happens, I'll let you know.
We'll say a little prayer for those astronauts.
You got it.
We'll be back in a moment. Open lines now. I'm going to open up an intuition hotline in a moment as well. I'll tell you about that. So get ready. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.